Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's having a voice treatment and will be back on the air tomorrow. Theories about the unconscious mind have been around for centuries, but until now, the science to back these theories up has been slim. That is changing. In a new book, a Washington Post science writer details recent research that explores how unconscious bias influences many of our actions and how we automatically rationalize the process. The book is called The Hidden Brain, and the author is Shankar Vedantam, who joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you so much, Susan. I'm very happy to be here.
We're going to invite our listeners to give us a call, add their thoughts, and join our conversation. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So your book is called The Hidden Brain. What does that mean?
The hidden brain is a metaphor, Susan. In our everyday lives, we think of ourselves as being conscious, autonomous, intentional creatures. We think we know why we do certain things, why we vote for this president, why we like that movie star. Much of my book details research conducted in the last decade or so, which shows that many of our intuitions about our own behavior are false or flawed. And I call the part of our brain that influences us without our awareness the hidden brain. It's essentially a metaphor for the unconscious mind.
So this is something that's useful and essential for us to have.
That's absolutely right. We would be lost without our hidden brains. In much of our everyday lives, the hidden brain is our ally and helps us do many of the things we want automated. The problem arises when we should be acting and thinking consciously, and we allow the hidden brain to do our thinking for us.
So what would be an example in everyday life of a situation in which your hidden brain might be having some influence that you don't even recognize?
So right now, there are probably people driving their cars who are listening to the radio show. And the reason they're able to listen to the radio show and listen to what I'm saying is that they're not thinking about driving. They don't have to think consciously about holding the steering wheel, about watching out for the truck that's coming out from the left, and when the light at the traffic signal is turning yellow. So it's a very simple example of how once we have mastered a skill, we essentially turn that skill over to the hidden brain. And the hidden brain does the job for us, freeing us up to focus on things that we find more interesting. It's a very simple example, but you can see why we would be lost in everyday life if we didn't have a hidden brain.
So that's pretty handy. But I wonder, are there ways that are less positive where your hidden brain may be influencing you in a way that you would say, no, that's outrageous. I would never, that's not what I think, or that's not influencing me.
Yes. So much of my book actually focuses on the downside of the hidden brain. I wanted to start off by mentioning something positive because I don't think the goal of the book is to eliminate the hidden brain altogether. But much of my book does focus on the biases that the hidden brain causes that are detrimental to us. The hidden brain influences us in adverse ways in any number of different settings. It influences how we make romantic decisions. It influences how we make financial decisions. It influences us when we hear a fire alarm go off in a workplace and we have to decide whether to get up and run or whether we should stay put in our chairs. It influences us when we're making judgments about other people, when we're trying to decide whether to hire someone for a job or whether to give someone a raise. It influences us when we're making moral judgments, when we're trying to decide whether, for example, to send a check to earthquake victims in Haiti right now.
Now, when we think about earthquake victims in Haiti, how does the hidden brain influence how we feel about what we see happening with the devastation in Haiti?
One of the errors that happens in our moral reasoning is that the hidden brain is not very good at comprehending large-scale disaster. Our empathic systems in our mind are really designed to focus on the plight of individual others, whether that's an individual animal, an individual human being, a face, a name, a story that we can latch onto around which we can wrap our empathy. When mass disaster strikes, such as an earthquake or a typhoon or war or famine, the victims end up numbering in the thousands. And at a conscious level, we know that a disaster that affects 1,000 people or 100,000 people is significantly greater than a disaster that affects one person. However, when you look at the data and how people respond to these disasters, people are able to muster far less empathy than is called for when disaster strikes at a mass level than when disaster strikes an individual.
You certainly see charities focus, utilizing this insight in that you can adopt a single child to try to help the mass of children around the world who need help. Or even in newspaper coverage of things like the Haiti disaster, a lot of focus on one family or one orphan really reflects what you're saying about the hidden.
Exactly. And I think journalists and charities in some ways have discovered this accidentally, and they've discovered it in the process of finding out what's effective with readers and what's effective with people in terms of getting them to donate a check. And many charities have found that when you tell people about the problem of famine in Africa, a problem that affects millions, people are much more unwilling to pull out their checkbook than when you give them a specific name and a specific face of a single person in Africa who is suffering from famine and saying, there is something that you can do to help this one person. The desire for us to focus on a single person is very strong, and this comes from a fundamentally good place, I think, but it leads us astray when we're trying to make moral judgments in situations of mass disaster.
Well, you write about a terrible disaster in our own history, the 9/11 attacks in 2001, and you contrast what happened on the 88th floor and the 89th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Tell us about that.
So the South Tower of the World Trade Center was the second tower to be hit on that awful morning. The North Tower was hit by the first plane, and the people in the South Tower had a 16-minute window in which they had to evacuate the building before the second plane struck. Now, of course, no one in the South Tower knew that a second plane was coming, and so these were people being asked to make a judgment about what they should be doing after seeing the adjoining tower struck by a plane. I focus on a single company, a financial company called Keefe, Bruyette & Woods, in one of the chapters of my book, and I describe a strange series of events that took place on the 88th and 89th floor of the South Tower of the World Trade Center. And when after the second plane had hit and the rubble had cleared, it turned out that everyone, or nearly everyone, on one floor had escaped and survived. And nearly everyone on another floor who had access to identical information had stayed behind at their desks and eventually perished. The chapter really explores the biases that that affect people in the course of disasters. We think of ourselves, again, as acting autonomously when a fire alarm goes off. It turns out that we do not, that when disaster strikes or where there is an ambiguous warning of disaster, we turn to the people around us to guide us, even when those people may not know very much more than we do. So the desire to form a consensus, to form a shared narrative about a disaster, constrains people from acting autonomously and constrains them from, in effect, using their conscious minds and their own judgments in deciding what to do.
So what is the lesson of a terrible situation like that? Are the other things that you explore when writing about the influences of this of your unconscious mind? What did you learn or take from the book in terms of what we should do about it?
One of the things that I take specifically on the issue of disasters is that it is unwise in disaster situations to focus on what the people around you are doing. There are times when the people around you know what they're doing, but very often they do not. And I think what happens in a disaster situation is, without our being aware of it, our autonomy, our ability to act autonomously, is impaired by those around us. And recognizing this bias, I think when the fire alarm goes off at your workplace next time, don't look at the person in the cubicle next to you and ask, you know, do you think it's a false alarm or should I be going out of the building? If a fire alarm goes off, do what you've been trained to do and what you've been taught to do, even if it is a false alarm. And you'll be surprised, perhaps, to learn that the people sitting next to you will follow your lead because they are being influenced by you as much as you're being influenced by them.
You, these situations, these trends or influences of the hidden brain are so subtle and so difficult to get to. I wonder, how is the research done so that we know more about it?
The research really follows a number of different strands, and I think you've hit on something really important here, Susan, because if you ask people after disaster settings, in disaster settings, why they did what they did, they will always give you conscious and deliberate explanations for what they did. They will say, I didn't get up because, and they will give you six reasons. Or they will say, I did get up because of, and they will give you six reasons. In the case of the disasters, there was a sociologist called Benigno Aguirre who, after the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center, sent out questionnaires to people. If you recall, a bomb went off in an underground parking lot at the World Trade Center in 1993. The buildings didn't collapse, but the buildings were ordered evacuated. And what the sociologist did was he figured out how quickly it took people to evacuate the buildings. And he found something very interesting. It didn't matter very much that whether people were on the 80th floor or on the 20th floor. So our intuitions would tell us that people on the 20th floor would be able to get out of the building faster than people on the 80th floor. It turned out that was not the case. What was decisive was the size of the groups that people belonged to. The larger the group that they were in, the slower it took for them to exit the building. The smaller the group they were in, the quicker it took to exit the building, because they were able to arrive at a shared explanation and a shared judgment about what to do.
You know, interestingly, you also write about people with brain disorders and how that can give us insight into how a normal brain works.
One of the chapters in the book explores the idea of what would happen if we didn't have a hidden brain. And I show through the story of an individual woman in Canada the profound disabilities it causes when we lose certain aspects of the hidden brain that regulate our social functioning. One of the things that our hidden brain does is it helps us navigate our social worlds effortlessly. It helps us understand how other people are thinking, what's happening in their heads. And we do all this without ever once thinking consciously about the person sitting across from us. But we read their body language, we read their body signals, we read how they're speaking to us, we read how their eyes look. And when you lose this ability, which is really an unconscious ability, it impairs us in ways that we would never have dreamed about.
We're talking to Shankar Vedantham about his new book. It's called The Hidden Brain: How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones and take some of your questions. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me in the studio is Shankar Vedantham. He's a science writer, author of The Hidden Brain. He writes the Department of Human Behavior column for The Washington Post. We're going to go to the phone shortly, 1-800-433-8850, and read some of your emails. You can email us at drshow@wamu.org. Well, we were talking before the break about how scientists have gotten insights into this subtle and mysterious thing you've dubbed the human brain. One of the interesting stories I thought was looking at gender bias and how what kind of person turned out to be best able to explore some of the subtleties of gender bias. What did you find?
There's a whole chapter in my book that I devote to the subject of gender bias. And one of the things that often happens when we see a person succeed or fail in the workplace is that we look for individual explanations. We look for things about that person's background or performance. And obviously, that's a very useful thing to do. What we're less able to see is what I call the undercurrent of sexism that runs through our everyday lives. I came by some really astonishing research some time ago that I describe in the book. looking at what happens to transgender people who go from male to female or female to male. And these are people who, before and after their transitions, of course, have the same skills and same experience and same educational background. And in a rational, conscious, intentional world, these people should be treated the same before and after. It turns out that there is compelling research that shows that this is not the case, that when women make a transition to being male, on average, their salaries go up, that they're received better, they're treated better, they're seen as being more competent. And when men transition to being women, the reverse happens. Their salaries often go down, and they're seen as being less competent than they were.
Amazing. Well, let's go to the phones and invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. Let's go first to Ralph. He's calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Ralph, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it. First of all, this is a subject that's near and dear to my heart because I presented it at the Global Risk Forum in Davos, Switzerland in 2008. And one of the things that I tried to present to people was what's called Consciente Cal by Paulo Freire. And what he talked about was raising this consciousness that you've alluded to of the hidden brain. And one of the things that I also talked about were the three different types of behavior that occurs, or three different types of phenomenon that occurs related to emergency and disaster management. One is convergence behavior, the other is divergent activity, and the third is emergent phenomenon, the new systems that start to emerge after a disaster occurs. And to give an example of this, there was last year there was a scientist in Torino, Italy, that had predicted the earthquake. But this was largely ignored because it was just so divergent from the, you know, from the ideals that of the status quo. So I guess my point to it is how much geography has to play with this hidden brain that's often ignored.
All right, Ralph. Thanks very much for your call.
Hi, Ralph. Thanks so much for the question. I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean by geography and its effects, but I certainly think that your point is very well taken in that warnings of disaster sometimes are not taken seriously unless they come from the center of systems. And then when they come from the periphery, they can often be ignored. The difficult thing in this research, of course, is that it's not always clear whether everything from the periphery is accurate. So part of the problem is that there are many things that come from the periphery that happen to be wrong. The challenge for us, especially when it comes to predicting disasters, is to try and weigh, you know, which predictions are more accurate than others.
All right. Thanks, Ralph. Tell us, why do people care so much about celebrities? You write about this in The Hidden Brain.
Well, there are probably many reasons we care about celebrities. One of the interesting strands of research that I've come by looks at evolutionary psychology as an explanation for why we care so intensely about celebrities. And the strand of research suggests that in the environment in which our brains evolved 50,000, 100,000 years ago, humans largely lived in small groups where they were surrounded by 100 or 150 people. Everyone whom we knew and saw in our living rooms, quote-unquote living rooms, were people who were in our immediate environment, people in our immediate surroundings. The theory that I've heard is that when we see celebrities and we see them constantly on television, we see these faces in our living rooms. And to our hidden brains, it's almost as if these people are physically present, that they become part of family. There's actually really striking research that shows that when the NBC show Friends was running, people who watched the show regularly reported that they actually had more friends in their real lives than people who didn't watch the show regularly. That at some level, television, you know, at a conscious level, we know that television is artificial, that the images we see on television are artificial. To our hidden brain, the images we see on television are real, and the people that we see on television all the time are really a part of our lives. And I think this is one reason why we care as much as we do about celebrities.
So it's not that we're crass and intrusive. It's that It's part of our evolutionary.
But... Well, you know, being crass and intrusive may also come partly from evolution. But I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, it's not just Hollywood stars who we think of as being family. People have intensely personal relationships to presidents and to, you know, to leaders in Congress. And it's the same phenomenon that we see Barack Obama's face on television all the time. And we develop visceral likes and visceral dislikes to the people whom we see in our living rooms, much as we do to family.
And maybe especially to his children, with whom we're going to be able to see perhaps grow up over the next couple of years. Well, your book, the subtitle of your book starts by saying how our unconscious minds elect presidents. What does the unconscious mind have to do when it comes to a presidential election?
I devote an entire chapter in The Hidden Brain to looking at the biases that played out in the 2008 presidential election. And they're really too varied to be able to mention with any depth here. I think there was a great deal of attention paid in the course of the campaign to conscious bias, to people who consciously said, for example, that they didn't want a woman to be president or didn't want a black man to be president. And almost no attention was paid to unconscious bias. And I try and argue and show empirically in the chapter that unconscious bias may have indeed been a more significant effect or had a more significant effect on the ways people vote. And the reason unconscious bias may have had such a significant effect is that people aren't aware of those biases. So when you have people who are objecting to Barack Obama because he's a black man, you can argue with those people about whether race is a meaningful factor and whether someone should be president. But when someone is against Barack Obama because he's a black man, but they're telling themselves that they are against him because they dislike his foreign policy, now you're having an engagement with them on a policy issue that ostensibly has nothing to do with race. And no matter how you try and argue with them, they come up with new explanations why they don't like Obama's policy on one issue or another. So because unconscious bias is unconscious, it can have a profound effect on our politics and, as I argue, on the 2008 presidential elections as well.
And yet Barack Obama managed to win the presidential election, even though he's an African-American running in a majority white electorate.
He did. And I think that is testament to the fact that unconscious biases are not an explanation that are be-all and end-all. So in other words, there are times we can overcome our biases, and there are times when the political currents are so strong that even if there are biases pushing in the opposite direction, you know, the overall force of the current is still strong enough to make someone president. It is true that Obama won fewer white voters than previous Democratic nominees. The Democratic Party has typically lost white voters, and Barack Obama lost by a very sizable margin among white men in particular, and among Southern white men in particular. And so if you look at the data, you can see that race did play some role in the election. I think it's fair to say, and in fact obvious to say, that race did not play a decisive role in this presidential election.
Let's go to New Jersey and talk to Natalie. Natalie, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
May I speak to...
Yes, please. Go ahead.
The reason I called was because when you mentioned the brain, I wanted to know what you thought of the gene factor in character. And the reason I'm asking is because I read a book on people in ancient times, like ancient Scots and Visigoths and people like that, who went into battle, and they went into battle naked. They only carried a shield and a helmet. And they were with each other so much, the men were with together so much, that they became sexually interested. And I was wondering, and the women were left alone too, and I was wondering, could this be a gene factor in what's happening now?
All right. Thank you. Thank you for your call, Natalie. What do you think?
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by a gene factor, Natalie. I do think that our biology provides us with, or provides our brains with, the architecture, if you will, on which culture and history write their messages. And so to the extent that your question is about how much is our behavior determined by nature or by nurture, I think the underlying architecture of the brain is indeed biologically driven. But the nature of our biases, what happens in our brains in terms of how those biases play out, which biases play out, is culturally and historically determined. One of the chapters in my book looks at the effects of small groups on individual behavior, and it looks specifically at the issue of suicide terrorism. But your question about small groups of people going into battle together prompted me to mention it. There is very powerful evidence that shows that when people spend a lot of time in very small groups and they're essentially cut off from the outside world, these small groups are able to rewrite norms of human behavior in very powerful ways. Now, I haven't seen research that suggests that these rewriting of norms extends to issues of sexual orientation. It has much more to do with norms of morality, norms of what's right, norms of what's acceptable and unacceptable. And it's my contention in the book that when it comes to suicide terrorism, it's the effects of small group psychology that are much more decisive than individual factors.
But how does that work if a terrorist group is trying to recruit a suicide bomber? How does a hidden brain play a role in convincing that person to undertake this mission that seems so unimaginable to most of us?
What I do in this chapter that looks at suicide terrorism is I look at it as a historical phenomenon because it actually goes a long time. It goes far back, actually. I mean, in the closing days of World War II, for example, the Japanese routinely used suicide bombers to try and hold off the Allies. In the 1980s, the Sri Lankan Tamil Tigers initially perfected the art of suicide bombing, and there have been a number of other examples ever since. What I try and show is that it is not individual factors that determines who becomes a suicide bomber and who does not. It may even be the case that large numbers of people, including large numbers of people listening to this show, could potentially be made into suicide bombers if they are placed in structures, very small groups, where you have intense loyalties form among the people in the group. So when people in military settings, and you read these stories all the time, the officer who leaps on a hand grenade in order to protect the people around him, what you see is that small groups of people who develop intense loyalties to one another are willing to give their own lives for the service of the group. And in every instance, historical instance, where suicide terrorism or suicide bombers have emerged, you find that they have emerged in these very small group settings where you have intense loyalties among groups of people that trump the loyalties that people have toward the larger world or the larger norms outside that little world.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls, 1-800-433-8850. You know, we're talking about terrorism. Of course, Americans are very concerned about terrorism and scared about terrorism. But you're right, if we were totally rational, we would be much more alarmed about cardiovascular disease because it's a bigger threat, more likely to be something that takes your life.
Yeah, I was reading this morning that President Obama is going to announce spending cuts in the next in a State of the Union address for everything that doesn't touch on national security. And one of the chapters in my book looks at how we make judgments about risk and the systematic biases that often affect us as we make these judgments about risk. I specifically compare the issue of terrorism to the issue of suicide in the United States. Most people think of suicide as something that happens to other people, but 30,000 Americans commit suicide every year. And if you were to add up the total number of Americans who have died from suicide and the total number of Americans who have died from terrorism since the morning of September 11, 2001, upward of 200,000 more Americans have committed suicide than have been killed by terrorism. And yet, when you think about our national priorities, if President Obama were to announce that he was going to make war on suicide and, you know, spend money to try and figure out ways to reduce suicide, you know, he would be lampooned as being irresponsible, as not taking America's interest at heart. And this puzzles me because when you look at the data, it seems quite clear that hundreds of thousands of Americans die every year from smoking-related diseases. Why don't we have a war on cancer that's on the same footing as our war on terrorism?
Let's go to Sheila. She's calling us from New York. Sheila, did you have a question or a comment?
Well, I had a question. I just wondered, humans seem to be in a constant state of denial, and I wondered if that was just an unconscious protection for our own benefit. Like, it's much easier for us to see the misdeeds or perceived lack of personal responsibility in others, while at the same time we completely dismiss it in ourselves, even going so far as to see ourselves as a victim so we can blame other people for our own lack of judgment or keeping up with things? And that's my question.
All right, Sheila, thanks for your call.
Sheila, I think that's a most insightful question because I think you've hit the nail exactly on the head. This is what people do. We are extremely attuned to the biases that affect other people, and we're almost completely unconscious to the biases that affect us. Much of what I write about in the book is really a call to get people to think about their own behavior much more carefully and systematically. You know, you can look at almost every domain of human behavior, from sports to politics to finance to romantic relationships to marriages, and you find the same pattern over and over again, that we are blind to our own failings and we are so extremely attuned to the failings of others. At some level, I guess you could argue this is protective. It certainly protects our own feelings, but you can also argue that this is detrimental because it keeps us from acting in ways that would help us most effectively.
Well, how about you yourself? You've spent all this time studying this topic, writing this book. Has it made you very aware of your own unconscious biases in your hidden brain?
You know, by definition, unconscious biases are unconscious. And, you know, I think one of the things that I've taken away after writing this book is that even when I come to strong conclusions about something, when I come to a, you know, believe that one policy position is correct and another policy position is complete nonsense, there's a voice at the back of my head that now says, well, you think you have thought about this very carefully, and you may indeed be right that you have thought about it carefully, but you have to admit the possibility that much of your reasoning may have been guided by factors that are outside your conscious awareness. One thing that I feel I have taken away from the writing of this book is that in some ways it has made me a little more cautious about my own certainties and perhaps a more humble person. And to that extent, I think it's been a useful personal exercise as well.
Shankar Vedantam has been talking about his new book, The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll go back to the phones, take some of your calls and questions, and read some of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, cybercrime. We talk with Barrett Lyon, a self-taught cybercrime fighter who stymied several attacks by cyber thugs and helped track them down in Russia and Ukraine. And we talk with Joseph Menn, author of the new book Fatal System Error, about how cybercriminals threaten the internet and businesses. Join us.
And Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm, with me in the studio, Shankar Vedantam, talking about his new book, The Hidden Brain. He's now on a Nieman Fellowship at Harvard University. Well, here we have an interesting email from Korea, writing us from Salt Lake City, Utah. She writes, several years ago, I was sitting on metal bleachers at an outdoor music festival. Clouds began to move in, and then we could hear thunder and see lightning in the distance. I thought to myself, it can't be too safe to sit on metal bleachers in a thunderstorm. But I looked around and no one else was leaving the stand, so I stayed. Fortunately, there was no incident, but I should have listened to my first reaction.
I think that's exactly right, Korea. It's a great story. And, you know, the thing is, I think, you know, you stayed because as you looked around, everybody else is staying. And there's a part of you which says, well, they must know what they're doing because they're all sitting. The problem is that you are contributing to that problem as well, because other people are looking at you and saying, well, she's staying and she must know something. And what happens in these situations is that everyone is looking at everyone else. What does also happen, however, in some cases, is that an individual or a group of individuals will get up. And one of the things I write about in the chapter where I talk about group behavior is the effect of leadership. One of the ways I think leadership manifests itself is when individuals break out from the pressure of the group. And the reason leaders often have a profound effect on what happens to groups is that the moment someone gets up, if one of the people had gotten up from the bleachers and had started to leave, I have little doubt that probably would have had an effect on others and then had a snowball effect very quickly.
So in those situations, trust your gut.
Well, I think what I'm saying is that you should trust what you know about lightning and thunder and metal bleachers. It's not so much your gut, because I think the gut would actually tell you to listen to the people around you. It's much more, I think, what Korea should have done is listen to what she herself knew was the best course of action.
Here's an email from Alan who writes, does this research suggest the human community should be seen not as a collection of individuals, but as a single organism or collection of organisms made up of individuals who are connected through their intellects in ways we are just beginning to understand?
Yes, I think that's a really insightful question, Alan. And, you know, it is true that we are individuals and we are able to act as individuals. But it is also true that in many, many significant ways, the groups that we belong to, the clubs we belong to, the memberships we have, the organizations we believe in, have really, really powerful effects on our behavior. We can see this, for example, in politics when we think about partisan behavior. And we look at how partisans line up in lockstep with everyone else in their party on every conceivable issue. And when we think about it, there really is no reason why people need to be for gun control and for abortion rights and for bigger government and for universal health care. Those are all different issues. But when you think about how partisan Democrats think, they all line up exactly on all those same issues. And some part of what's driving this is not their conscious thinking on each of those issues, but the fact that they're part of a team and that the team has decided that it's going to go one way and they have to go the same way too. The same, of course, applies to Republicans as well.
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri and talk to Lugano. You've been holding on for a long time. Thanks.
Thank you, ma'am. I want to ask you to help me to understand something, please. And tomorrow is a big day of State of the Union. But do you know at what level of emotional intensity hidden brain biases will override common sense? For example, last time Congressman Wilson disrespected publicly the president and shouted out, "You lie."
Well, Lugano, thank you for the call. I do think that emotions play a very powerful role, and there are times when our emotions do indeed override our better judgment. I find it difficult to say very much about an individual event, because when a congressman yells out, "You lie," is that because of unconscious bias? Is that something that has been carefully thought out? From the individual instance, I'm not sure you can really tell, because I think both explanations are, you know, entirely plausible. It is the case, of course, that our emotions play a very powerful role, and they play very positive roles for much of our lives. Our emotions guide us in our romantic decisions, in our parenting decisions, in our patriotism, and those are wonderful things. There are also times when our emotions guide us astray. And so my point that I'm trying to make in the book is not so much that our emotions are problematic, but that we need to be able to weigh when our emotions are positive and useful and when they're problematic.
You write that we are perhaps born with an inclination to trust people who look like us and distrust people who don't look like us.
So one of the earliest biases that occurs among human beings is the biases to recognize certain kinds of faces. And again, you can see why this has very useful evolutionary survival value. Within, I think, a few hours, newborn babies are able to recognize human faces from other kinds of faces. And within a few more hours, they're able to preferentially recognize the faces of their caregivers, their mothers in particular. And over time, babies learn to make very fine distinctions between people whom they see all the time. And if you're a baby born in China, then the faces you're going to see around you are going to be predominantly Chinese faces, and you're able to make very fine distinctions among those faces. Eventually, in the course of time, what happens is your familiarity with faces can bias you in your judgments about what people are saying, and you're more likely to take seriously things that people from your own ethnic group are saying than people from other ethnic groups.
So if you're a Chinese baby who grows up in China, you'll tend to trust Chinese people first. That'll be something that's from your earliest days. But what if you were born in China but adopted by a couple in the United States who are just Caucasian, who are not Chinese? Would you trust people who look like your parents, your adoptive parents, or would you trust people who are really from the ethnic group into which you were born?
Well, it's my belief that our cultures are really the determining force here. So in other words, if you have a Chinese baby who's adopted by a couple in Iowa, that baby is going to grow up thinking of Iowa as home and thinking about Iowa as the place, you know, which he or she thinks about as being a cultural reference point, a normative reference point. So it really is our immediate and environments that determine, you know, what messages get written on the brain. The brain just provides us the architecture, if you will, on which the software of our cultures and histories can unfold.
So the Chinese baby in Iowa, who would they trust innately?
Well, I'm not sure the issue so much is trust. The issue so much is familiarity or unfamiliarity. Mm-hmm. And I think if you are in an environment where you're being exposed to a number of different kinds of faces, your familiarity with a number of different kinds of faces, you know, is going to be increased. So, for example, I grew up in India, and I'm able to make extremely fine distinctions between Indian faces without even thinking about them, because over time, my mind has been exposed to tens of thousands of Indian faces. And so over time, my mind is able to make these very fine distinctions. When I'm asked to make a judgment about two people from an ethnic group that I might be less familiar with, and I'm called, for example, to be a witness in a crime, and I'm trying to tell apart two people from an ethnic group that I'm unfamiliar with, my hidden brain lacks the tools to be able to make those very fine distinctions. And so what you have is a greater propensity for error in judgment and error in recognition.
So certainly that's something we've read about in the criminal justice system when it comes to making cross-racial identifications in crimes. And in fact, the very first anecdote in your book deals with a woman who was the victim of a crime, identified her attacker, years later discovered she was wrong.
Yeah, so this describes a woman who was a victim of a crime and was very certain when she identified a person that he was the assailant. And it turned out that years down the road, after the man had been convicted and sent to jail, that a DNA test was conducted that proved that he could not have been the criminal. And you have the same phenomenon occur many, many times in our criminal justice system. One of the things that we believe as a society is that we shouldn't take race into account when we are in the criminal justice system. Our society believes in the ideal of colorblindness. And so if you were to go to a judge or a jury and say, you know, here's a black person making an identification of a black person, or here's a white person making an identification of a black person, most juries and judges would think that's inappropriate to introduce the subject of race in identifications. The research evidence, however, very clearly shows that we are far more skilled at making accurate distinctions among people from our own ethnic group, and that in some ways not taking race into account in the criminal justice system is what leads to outcomes that are racist.
Here's an email we have from a trial attorney named Michael. He says, "My experience is that jurors first use their hidden brain to evaluate witnesses, evidence, and the like first, and then rationalize their gut feelings through logic and reasoning. Law firms pay considerable amounts to jury consultants, focus groups, and the like to get this input." Is this something that you've looked at?
I haven't looked at it specifically, but I think I would agree almost completely with Michael. I think people do make these snap judgments very early when they're evaluating other people, and then they spend a lot of time in their hidden minds explaining to themselves why their initial gut instincts were correct. I think it's not surprising, therefore, that law firms, you know, pay enormous amounts of money not just to hire the best lawyers, but to hire the people who look like the best lawyers and to get jurors who will more likely be sympathetic to your client than not. And again, these are biases that are not talked about in the criminal justice system, or at least they're not dealt with in an open manner. And so what you often have is sort of these masses of unconscious biases among prosecutors and defense attorneys and jurors and lawyers and certainly eyewitnesses all mashing up against one another in a criminal justice trial.
So should we be we as a society be addressing this in a more direct way?
I think we should, but I think the challenge of doing so in the law is really daunting. I think it's much simpler to assume that we can all think rationally, that if we mean to be fair, that we will end up being fair. And that's an assumption that we make routinely in the criminal justice system. If we were to admit the possibility that jurors who are well-meaning and well-intentioned and who want to be fair are indeed being biased by these factors that are very subtle and outside their own conscious awareness, how do we begin to address that? How do we begin to take apart this problem? Our whole criminal justice system, our law in some ways, is premised on the belief that humans are rational, autonomous, intentional creatures, that if someone does something, it's because they meant to do it. If someone said something, it's because they meant to say it. If you admit the possibility of the unconscious mind into that system, it opens up reams of trouble. And I, for one, am not entirely sure how you address that problem. I think my book has done a better job articulating that the problem exists than figuring out how the problem should be solved.
Well, one thing that we have seen is increasing reliance on science in criminal justice trials, things like DNA evidence that seems more reliable than relying, for instance, on what a witness might tell you.
Yeah, so I think that is certainly the case. And I think what you're getting at in some ways is the one thing we can measure very accurately are outcomes. And so one of the things that we can do is to try and figure out whether there's bias at play, is to figure out what are the outcomes that we're seeing from criminal justice trials. One of the chapters in my book, for example, looks at the effects of skin tone on criminal justice outcomes in serious cases involving the death penalty. And there's very compelling research that shows that African-American defendants who are darker skinned are more than twice as likely to be sentenced to death as African-American defendants who are lighter skinned for crimes of equivalent seriousness.
Is it possible for people to address these unconscious bias when it comes to race and overcome it or minimize racism when it comes to your judgment about other people?
I think the first thing that we have to do is put this issue on the table and say it's a real issue and not just say racism is the problem of rednecks who believe that black people should have nooses tied around their necks. When we start to think about the idea that racism might be my problem, sexism might be my problem, even if I'm a woman, sexism might still be my problem. When we begin to say I might myself be the agent of bias, I think that's a first and very important step in saying, well, how might I be acting in ways that are biased? What can I do to correct my own biases? Who can I reach out to? Who can second guess me? Who can provide me with alternate points of view?
All right. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Sterling. He's calling us from Highland, Utah. Hi, Sterling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I would like to understand, how would you describe the social and maybe unconscious biases that influence what we see in the news on a daily basis? And from my observation, it seems that we tend to focus much more on the acute problems that are that affect things like terrorism, earthquakes in Haiti, hurricanes Katrina. They get significantly more press coverage, when in fact there are much more difficult and substantive problems that are more chronic, such as traffic deaths, cancer, HIV, starvation, access to clean water. Why is it that we don't see more, I guess, press coverage for those things that are perhaps even bigger problems?
Okay, thank you, Sterling, for your call.
Sterling, that's a really insightful question, and I'm so glad you asked it. I completely agree with you. The media, in some ways, are responding to what their audiences want to hear. I'm not disavowing responsibility for the media. I'm a reporter myself, and I fully agree with you that the media needs to do a much better job focusing on systemic problems, long-term problems, rather than acute problems. But the real challenge is that it's not just that reporters are biased and have hidden brains as well. It's that the audience does, too. That if you had a news channel that focused, for example, on chronic problems, on traffic deaths and suicide and HIV mortality, and you had another news channel that was flashing you terror alerts all the time, most people would tune into the channel that is telling us about the terror alert. The problem is that our minds, as audience members, are tuned to certain kinds of threats and are largely oblivious to other kinds of threats. One of the things that I'm hoping will come out from the book, and in some ways this is one of the most important things, is that we will trust the data more in making our judgments about risk, that when we are deciding our national priorities, we will trust what the data tell us about how many Americans are affected, how many Americans die, rather than our gut about which problems to focus on and which ones to ignore.
Let's go to Madeline. She's calling us from Florida. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I read a book some time ago that basically said that fear, that initial gut feeling that you have, is what saves people from the difference between being a victim of a crime or not. Because if you act on it, then it possibly can get you out of that situation. And in fact, since I've read it, that it has happened to me where I've realized that I could focus on that gut feeling of fear and get out, and I was able to then avert what ended up being a problem. Now, in what I've heard today on your show is that there are also biases that control our behavior. How does one go about distinguishing? And I would ask that your guest simply just comment on his opinion about how would you go about distinguishing when is that fear trustworthy and when is it based on bias? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Madeline.
Madeline, another excellent question. Thank you so much for asking it. I think fear is an enormously useful emotion, and it's extremely useful in helping us navigate our worlds. So fear is what helps me slam on the brakes when I see a car coming out of the corner of my eye without even being fully aware of what I'm doing. It's fear that tells me act on this and act on it right away. So my book is not really aimed at the idea that emotions are bad or always dangerous. My book is aimed at the idea that we need to be conscious about what we are doing. So when we are walking down a street and we see someone following us on the street and we feel fear and we are asking ourselves, is that fear rational or not? In some ways, we are doing what my book says that we should be doing. We're taking the emotion and we're acting on it consciously.
Shankar Vedantam, I want to thank you for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show to talk about your new book, The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives.
Thank you so much, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.